Hello and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host. It's our first show of the last month of the year. Happy December. We have a listener of the week. It's Tracy Kramer. She is Vice President of Development at Habitat for Humanity, New York City. She writes on LinkedIn to Lawrence Pagnoni. I just heard your interview with Tony Martinetti. I wanted to tell you I am rushing out to buy your book. Everything resonated. Can't wait to read it. Tracy Kramer, don't waste money buying great guests' books. Just listen to the show. If you listen to Nonprofit Radio, that was an hour with Lawrence Pagnoni. You got everything you needed. I'm sorry you're spending your money on the book. It's just not necessary. No. Tracy Kramer, listener of the week. I love it. I love that it all resonated with you. Lawrence Pagnoni was an outstanding guest. Cool. Congratulations, Tracy. Oh, you know I'm glad you're with me. I'd be forced to endure the pain of neurochoroiditis if I saw that you missed today's show. Ask when not asking. Strong, real, donor-centered programs save you money because you'll hold on to existing donors rather than having to find new ones. Marcy Brenholz knows how. She is Director of Development at the Ralph Lauren Center for Cancer Care and Prevention, and that originally aired November 21st, 2014, and it was recorded at Fundraising Day 2014 in New York City. And What Are the Wealthy Thinking? Stacey Palmer and Glenn McDonald dish on the changing landscape of philanthropy, what giving habits persist, and what new trends are developing. Stacey is editor of The Chronicle of Philanthropy, and Glenn is president of Wealth and Giving Forum. That's also from November 21 last year and recorded at Fundraising Day last year. On Tony's Take Two, thank you. We're sponsored by Pursuant, full-service fundraising, data-driven, and technology-enabled. Pursuant.com. Here is Ask When Not Asking with Marcy Brenholz.
Welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio coverage of Fundraising Day 2014. We are at the Marriott Marquis Hotel in Times Square, New York City. With me now is Marcy Brenholz. Her seminar topic is How to Ask When You Aren't Asking. Marcy is Director of Development for the Ralph Lauren Center for Cancer Care and Prevention. Marcy Brenholz, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tony. Good to be here.
Oh, thank you. What a pleasure. Pleasure to have you. How to ask when you aren't asking. Right. What are nonprofits not quite getting right about stewardship?
Well, I think, you know, in this day and age, we have a lot of focus on acquisition, and acquisition is really expensive. So there's direct costs like buying lists if you're doing direct mail. There's also staff costs for prospect research and things like that. It's a lot less expensive to hold on to the donors you already have, but it's not the easiest thing to do. So in the seminar, I'm going to kind of break it down into two things that you can do. One is getting your house in order at your organization. So meaning your acknowledgement process is streamlined, you have a great way of recognizing staff, might redo your cash report, some kind of really boring things like that. Make an assessment of what kind of stewardship each department is doing if you're a bigger organization. And then the more fun part of it is to think about what you have to offer to your donors that's really special. Do you have access to celebrities? And that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, Beyonce and Jay-Z. It could be an expert in the field where you work. It could be a great event that you do. You could add on a opening session for special donors. There could be travel. Any number of things that you can do to make donors really feel like they're part of your work.
All right. So why don't we start with the more dry but still important.
Yeah.
Right? You got to get yourself in order before you can go outside.
Yeah.
We have a good amount of time together, so where should we start with assessing? I mean, how do we figure out where we're... What do we need to look at to figure out where we are, and then we'll look at where we got to go?
Yeah, well, I think it depends on the size of your organization. So the case study that I'm going to use is from the U.S. Fund for UNICEF, where I worked for about 3.5 years. It's a bigger organization, a bigger staff. So what we did is we put together a working group. I mean, people hear the words working group and just generally roll their eyes, but sometimes they can be effective. We made sure we had representation from all of our departments. And during the first meeting, we just talked about what we thought would be challenging for donor retention. So at a place like the U.S. Fund, for instance, we acquired a lot of donors through emergencies. the Indian Ocean tsunami, the Haiti earthquake, et cetera. And then we really struggled to have plans about holding on to those donors.
Okay.
So we talked a lot about whether we were being donor-centric as an organization. So
I've had two interviews. You're my second interview so far.
Everyone's
the first one was all about donor-centrism. He was CEO of Food for the Poor in Florida and concerned about donor-centrism as well, but trying to make it true, not just a flash phrase that doesn't really have meaning behind it.
Yeah, it's kind of a buzzword, but you know, the way I think about being donor-centered, and if it's not kind of resonating for you, every fundraiser kind of has low moments. You know, why did I become a fundraiser? Why am I doing this? And for me, going back to being donor-centric can make you feel better in a way. If you think about why donors are giving to you and how much of their time and personal resources they're devoting because they believe in your cause, it makes you want to be donor-centric. It makes you want to be a good friend in a way. You know, if you have a friend who's incredibly supportive and thoughtful, who remembers your birthday, always asks you about important things in your life, you know, who shows up at your party with a great hostess gift every time, and then you do nothing in return, you're not being a good friend. So that's like being donor-centric. If the donor is so generous to you, but you're not respectful of his or her wishes, you know, you're just not doing the right thing. There's such a thing as doing the right thing, right?
Yeah.
So,
Well, where should we look specifically to determine whether we are doing the right thing?
Well,
our marketing communications, our which includes the website and print, and you know, let's drill down to some of the things we should be looking at specifically.
I think probably where to start is financial accountability. Kind of a buzzword these days, I think, but making sure that you're letting your donors know, and this is the drier stuff. Again, this is the getting your house in order stuff. Making sure that your donors know where their money is going and making sure that you're respecting where they told you they wanted it to go. You know, there's some great donors who say, here's some money. I don't care what you do. It can be operating costs. It can be salaries. And then there are other donors who say, no, I really want it to go to this specific program. And we have to make sure that we're being accountable to the donors.
And I like your word, too, respectful.
Yeah.
Respectful of what their wish is when they do make a designation.
Right. Back to the friendship example. You know, it's just what's the right thing in the friendship, in the exchange.
Yeah.
You mentioned website. It's a great point. Yeah. You know, there are all of these charity rating organizations now, including Charity Navigator, who look at two things. They look at your finances, so they'll read through your audited financial statements and your 990s. They also want to see certain things posted on your website, and that includes your audits and your 990s and your leadership staff. And you have to really be telling donors how you run your organization and not be afraid of letting them in. I think we're often afraid that donors will find something out about us that they don't like. And that's what marketing communications is for. It's for telling the story. But you really do have to be pretty open with your donors, I think, in the more sophisticated days where we live. So making sure that stuff is up on your website is great for ratings on Charity Navigator, but again, it's just the right thing to do also.
Interesting parallel about not fearing letting donors in.
Right.
I think of a parallel with social media. You know, everybody's got a Facebook page now, but the early fear was, well, what if donors post comments that we don't like?
Right.
And there haven't been many instances of that, and when it does happen, it's an open communication. And if it's, of course, if it's blatant and doesn't belong, it can always be eliminated. Deleted, but that's the rare exception.
Yeah,
you know, it's a conversation, right? It's a dialogue, and so we shouldn't fear the openness. And now Facebook pages are rampant.
Yeah,
but four or five years ago, the fear was, well, we can't let donors post on our new Facebook page. They might say things we don't like.
Right. Yeah. Reputational risk is obviously huge, and the problem with the Google accessible world, right, is that you can find, if there was a faux pas in a nonprofit's past, it's just like any person, it's going to be on the internet. So if some risk to your reputation occurs, it lasts forever. So it makes a lot of sense that we're apprehensive, but I think you're making a great point. If someone comes out, whether it's on your Facebook page or if they send you a private message and says, I'm really worried about some aspect of your business practices. I'm really worried about your program design. It's a great opportunity to be able to say, you know what? This is how we really do it. Let's have a conversation. So, yeah, I mean, it's a lot to manage. It's a lot more to manage than we've ever had. But I agree. It's a good opportunity to be out there.
And that person who's saying that to you cares about you.
Yeah.
If they didn't care, they would have just written you off and said, oh, they're screwing it up. I'm not going to bother. But they do care enough to learn, and maybe, and they're even trying to help.
Yeah. And just to bring it back to donor retention, to our topic, if someone cares and they have a concern and you address it, you probably have that person for life, right? Yeah. I mean, if you're honest, if you're open, if you're thoughtful about how you're telling your story, you're going to be able to hang on to donors, and it's better in the long run for your business.
What else should we be doing internally?
Yeah.
Getting our own house in order. Where else should we look?
So I think once you're kind of clear that you're out there, that you're financially accountable, then a lot of what I encountered when I was looking at stewardship, again, I'm using the U.S. Fund as an example, but this is applicable to other places too, is how motivated staff were to retain donors. So sometimes the way organizations put together their cash report or the way that they recognize fundraisers might recognize acquisition more than it recognizes retention. So just making sure that you're making sure that it's really a priority for your staff. And
they're being recognized and evaluated on the right kind of metrics.
Right.
Retention as well as acquisition.
Yeah, exactly. And internally, a lot of organizations have started to measure their retention, but they don't necessarily measure upgrades or donor satisfaction. And I'm just going to name check here because this is not something that I thought of. This is actually from Karen Osborne of the Osborne Group. And these are her recommendations specifically to measure retention, upgrades, and donor satisfaction as a way to make sure that you have a healthy stewardship or donor relations program going on.
Okay.
So some organizations are not even measuring retention necessarily, so that's a great place to start. But measuring how often you're moving the donors up the pipeline, that's also really helpful. And then whether or not donors think that your mission is crucial, whether they feel that you're one of their top five organizations, how committed are they to you? That reflects on how you're communicating with them.
How do you judge these things?
Well, if you have a donor database, again, I'm talking about a little bit of a bigger organization, right, you can actually run reports on these kinds of things. You can set them up in an...
Oh, I meant... that's okay. No, I meant do donors feel that your mission is critical? Are you one of their top five charities? That's got to all be done by survey, conversation?
Yeah. So if you want to do... You can do a donor satisfaction survey with smaller donors. You can do it online. But you can also sit down, when you're talking about major donors or board members, you can do individual interviews with them where you're really not asking them. So why I called the session How to Ask When You're Not Asking, I hope everyone doesn't show up and think, oh, good, I don't have to solicit anymore. Marcy's going to tell me how.
Yeah, no, no.
Right. It's more, what are the moves that you're doing in between the asks that are making the donor feel really good and really invested in you? So sitting down and talking to them about what they think about the organization without asking them to write a check could be a good move. You know that old saying, if you want to ask for money, ask for advice?
Yeah, right.
It's like right. that. So you would do it face-to-face, or you could do, you know, an online survey or something like that and agree maybe to do it every 2 or 3 years. You know, what I'm talking about really takes a lot of resources and not every small organization. So now I'm a one-person shop at my new job. And this kind of thing is probably going to be a little bit more challenging than it was when I had more resources at a bigger place. So that too.
But you're going to find a way.
Yeah. I mean,
What's not to love about nonprofit radio? Tony gets the best guests. Check this out from Seth Godin.
This is the first revolution since TV 1950 and Henry Ford 1920. It's the revolution of our lifetime.
Here's a smart, simple idea from Craigslist founder Craig Newmark.
Yeah, insights or in presentation or anything, people don't really need the fancy stuff. They need something which is simple and fast.
When's the best time to post on Facebook? Facebook's Andrew Noyes knows.
Traffic is at an all-time high around 9 a.m. or 8 p.m. So that's when you should be posting your most meaningful posts.
Here's Aria Finger, COO of DoSomething.org.
Young people are not going to be involved in social change if it's boring and they don't see the impact of what they're doing. So you got to make it fun and applicable to these young people, because otherwise a 15 and 16-year-old, they have better things to do. They have Xbox, they have TV, they have their cell phones.
Ami Dar is the founder of Idealist.
It took 2 or 3 years for foundation staff to sort of deign to add an email address to their card. It was like, it was phone. This email thing is weird. And plus, why should I give it away?
Charles Best founded DonorsChoose.org.
Somehow they've gotten in touch, kind of offline, as it were.
Yeah.
And they'll do exchanges of brownies and visits and physical gift.
Mark Echo is the founder and CEO of Echo Enterprises. You may be wearing his hoodies and shirts. Tony talked to him.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big believer that it's not what you make in life. It's you know, it's how you make people feel.
This is public radio host Majora Carter.
Innovation is in the power of understanding that you don't just, you know, you just put money on a situation and expect it to heal. You put money on a situation and invest it and expect it to grow.
And savvy advice for success from Eric Saperstein.
What separates those who achieve from those who do not is in direct proportion to one's ability to ask others for help.
The smartest experts and leading thinkers are on Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%.
Now, so a one-person fundraising shop.
Mm-hmm.
You are talking to donors a lot.
Yeah, all
so,
day.
So some of these questions could weave their way into your daily conversations with donors. Maybe not every one,
right?
But you can sample, right?
Yeah. And one of the things that I'm doing, so there was a one-year gap between development directors at the Ralph Lauren Center. So some of the things that I'm doing there are sort of resurrecting some relationships that we had before, and I'm making sure that there's no stone unturned. If you've given money to us before, if you've cared about us before, I'm going to try to bring you back. You can't be successful all the time. You're going to lose some donors. People's circumstances change. It might have nothing to do with your organization, but it's really important to make sure that you're being very methodical about renewing.
Let's switch to the more fun, the donor side of good donor stewardship.
Yeah. So, I had a great experience, again, at the U.S. Fund for UNICEF, where I put together a major donor giving society, now ably managed by another colleague at the U.S. Fund. But we decided to do, back to serving donors, we decided to talk to our board members about what they might like to see. So when you structure a major donor giving society, you're basically putting together a list of tiered benefits. And that's also an important part of putting your house in order.
Yeah.
What are you offering to donors at different levels? Is it consistent? Who are the donors that your leadership and board members need to be involved with? And do you have plans for how to steward those donors? So U.S. Fund for UNICEF is lucky. They have a lot of board members. So they have a national board and then 7 regional boards. So
some people may say that's very unlucky. And
that's true.
Thankfully, it was fortunate for the U.S. Fund.
Yeah, it was. I mean, these board members are great. I'm a board relations person, so right, I think that's great. And some people think it's a nightmare. Yep. Now I have an 8-person board, so I've gone from
yep. Yeah.
But they have probably about 125 board members between all those groups. And we did some surveying of them, and I'm not saying that these are the answers you would get from every group of board members, but this is the kind of thing that, like, on your terrible worst day, you just think about it and feel good. These board members were like, I don't care about recognition. That's fine. I just want to be more connected to the mission. I just want to talk to the workers in the field and really understand what you do. They were looking for these really meaningful engagement opportunities. It wasn't like, oh yeah, I'd like a tote bag, or I'd really like to meet Beyonce when I'm name checking her. Maybe she'll call me. You know, they really wanted more programmatic depth, and they also wanted to network and connect with each other. So we tried to build benefits that felt a little bit less transactional and more kind of life affirming.
Like what? What were a couple of examples?
Well, you know, again, this is not something that everyone can offer, but okay. Travel to the field is an example. At a certain...
Yeah, okay, but a small organization, maybe it's not travel to an exotic country,
right.
But maybe welcome to the to our office.
Yeah.
To the place where we're serving people that you've never seen. I mean, you know, we internally take it for granted because it's on the floor below us, so mm-hmm. it's down the hall. Mm-hmm. But our donors have never seen it. However modest you may think it is, it might mean the world to the donor to be invited. Right?
Absolutely. I mean, at the Ralph Lauren Center, so I work on site at the Cancer Center. It's in Harlem on 124th and Madison. I'll be honest, a lot of donors don't go up to that neighborhood very often. Because of the involvement of Ralph Lauren, the center is really beautiful looking. And I love walking in there every day and seeing the patients in the waiting room. Not, it's a very unhappy time for the patients.
Yeah.
But I feel really connected to them and to the mission. And we do a lot of site visits at the Ralph Lauren Center. Before UNICEF, I worked at a education nonprofit called Learning Leaders, and we did school volunteerism. So we used to do a lot of site visits to schools, and that was great. And whenever I was feeling kind of disconnected at Learning Leaders, I would get up and go to a school and be like, okay, this is why I'm doing this. So yeah, the travel with UNICEF is a little sexier.
Right, but every charity has got some place that you can come.
Yes. Absolutely.
Or some meeting that you can come to that you haven't previously been invited to.
Yeah.
Something is going on at your charity.
I just went to a special events training session at Robin Hood. So the Ralph Lauren Center is a Robin Hood grantee. And the special events staff was sharing that their donors love to come to their office and just see where the work is done. So
just the administrative, like ministerial type offices.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the stuff that the people who work there take for granted every day. Has no interest. I mean, it has interest to them, but right. They would never think of inviting an outsider. But you got to stop thinking like that.
Mm-hmm.
They're not outsiders; they're insiders, and we want to welcome them. Welcome them to the workplace.
Yeah.
Maybe you do it one day a month. Mm-hmm. You have a bunch of invite a bunch of people and have a breakfast, and maybe you know that half a day a month becomes more donor centric than the other 19 and a half work days that you have in the month.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why I found the responses from the board members at the U.S. Fund so encouraging, because they were saying exactly what you were saying. We want to know how you do your work. We want to really drill down with you. We're not necessarily looking for lots of glitzy stuff. We want the day-to-day. And it kind of relates to financial accountability also.
Fixing your mic so it doesn't fall off the table.
Thank
there you. You go.
Right, I'm getting violent with my mic.
Better that than me.
Yeah.
Although we're close enough, you could, but... I appreciate your not breaking down that barrier.
You haven't done anything yet. It's been okay.
Okay.
Not feeling aggressive.
Okay. All right. I'll mind myself. Right. I won't cross the line either.
This relates back to financial accountability. Again, if we're afraid to let donors in, then they're not going to come closer to us, and we want them to be closer to us. Not every single donor, but the important ones and the ones who care. So, yeah.
Okay.
That's the interesting part.
So that was at U.S. Fund for UNICEF, it was... Travel abroad.
Travel abroad
we've
is
made
big.
It clear that it could be traveling to your administrative office.
Yes.
What else did you do on the outside?
It can be also individualized reporting. So back to how donors want their money spent. You know, a lot of us do kind of a general operating support report, which is okay. But at certain levels, you really want to make sure that you're doing an individualized report. And, you know, I think most of us do this. But that was included because UNICEF being such a big place, sometimes people were getting a more generalized report and not feeling like we were really drilling down into the program that they wanted to support. Then we did a couple of other things, like at the higher levels, dinner hosted by a board member, dinner hosted by the global UNICEF executive director. So that thing that I said about celebrities before, a lot of people think that Tony Lake, who is the executive director of UNICEF globally, is a celebrity. In the world of, you know, international charitable work, people really want to meet Mr. Lake, and he's more of an academic than he is anything else. But that's really interesting to donors. So we did travel to see UNICEF's work in the field, and then UNICEF has some other interesting international properties to visit. There's a research center in Florence. There's a supply division in Copenhagen. So travel to those places also, which is, again, inner workings.
Yeah. Okay, but we covered travel.
Yeah.
By the way, your phone is ringing. I think it is Beyonce.
Good.
I heard a phone ringing.
But this is more important. I mean, I'll get to her after.
I agree. It is. You're... everything in the world in your life has brought you to this moment.
Exactly.
You don't want to surrender it to Beyonce.
No.
Besides, it might have been someone else's phone I heard.
I hope so.
She could actually be calling someone else.
I always
else.
Keep mine on silent.
She could be calling someone else. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
You're next on the list, I'm sure.
I'm sure.
What else? Fun
what
stuff.
What else do we put on there? Yeah. So receptions before big events, if you're having a gala.
Right. You don't have to spend a lot of money to add a small reception before. Right. You've already got the space. The caterer is already coming.
Yeah.
The marginal cost of that before or after reception, not very
Nothing.
Great, right?
Especially when you're putting on a bigger event.
Yeah.
And that gets to the donors wanting to network with each other and to know each other. They don't always get to be in the same place either. And, you know, a board meeting or another kind of meeting isn't always the best place to network. So something like that, which is pretty
I do
simple.
A lot. My work is planned giving consulting.
Mm-hmm.
And we do a lot of those VIP receptions before the larger event.
Right.
Another thing that doesn't cost much is VIP seating at an event.
Yeah.
It costs nothing. It costs a couple of strips of masking tape.
Yeah.
To mask off an area and have VIP seating for an event you've already paid for the tickets for. You've already got the seats. Rope off 10 or 12 seats for VIPs. People feel like the world. Oh, they gave us VIP seats.
Yeah. And right. You know what's funny about that? We're all already doing it, right? When you think about it, when you're doing your gala seating, you are putting your most important people in the front, but they don't know that. We're not revealing our methods. So if you make that a little more open and say, by the way, we're gonna give you the best seats. Right. You're this important. I think, you know, we're continuing on that theme of tell your donors what you're doing, and it might make them feel good. So, yeah, agreed.
Okay. What else? We still have a couple minutes left, Marcy. What else can we talk about?
Well, we could talk about volunteer opportunities, maybe. I think that is a big thing that's emerging.
Volunteers helping with stewardship?
Donors having volunteer opportunities to make them feel more engaged.
Okay.
I think it's emerging as a theme because corporate supporters often are asking, well, how can my employees come for a day and do something? And it's a little bit difficult for some organizations to figure out how to do that. I had the luck. This is back to sometimes stewardship moves are a little easier at one place or another, or a little more obvious. When I worked at a volunteer organization, I got a lot of my donors and my board members through a pipeline of one particular volunteer program, which was an art program. And it just attracted the kind of volunteers who were also able to be donors.
Yeah.
Not everybody has that. So Ralph Lauren Center does a lot of stuff with our physical plants, having people come in and paint, having people come in and plant flowers outside. You know, I just think it's important to make sure that you have at least a couple, just up your sleeve and ready to go, a couple of volunteer opportunities in case either a corporate supporter asks or, you know, a group of board members or a group of donors say, I don't really feel like writing another check. What can I do? So that's, you know, I think that's big. And a lot of donors also want to do things that involve their children and family. Family philanthropy is such a big emerging topic. So if you can think of a program or a volunteer opportunity where people can bring their children, that's also huge.
We have just a couple minutes left. What about the board's role in stewardship?
Oh, yeah, that's a really good question.
Okay, well, I'll come up with one. It only took me about 24 minutes.
Well, I mean, this is like a house in order. It's like, you know, it's the more kind of the more boring stuff. So I had mentioned that a board-hosted annual dinner could be an interesting big stewardship move.
Right.
But thank you calls, thank you notes, all those kinds of things.
I hear that from a lot of guests. Just get the board together, do it for an hour before a meeting.
Right.
And they're going to get a great feeling from it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just you're just calling to say thank you.
Thank you. Nothing else.
Don't do anything more. We're not asking for anything more. I'm just calling to say thank you. And a donor has gotten a call from a VIP in the organization. It's a board member.
It's really big.
It's a big deal.
People, a lot of people in the international world love to support the Carter Center because the Carter Center does great work. But also Jimmy Carter calls you. I've had a bunch of donors be like, President Carter called me. Okay, so not everybody has Jimmy Carter, but it's still important to hear from, you know, a leadership voice. If you
mentioned,
really,
you mentioned the executive director,
yeah,
who's not really thought of as a celebrity in
the world,
in popular media,
yeah,
but within the organization and within that mission, he's very well known.
Yeah,
so it could just be somebody in your office.
Exactly, and also I didn't mention loyalty recognition. I think calling donors and thanking them for a gift that they've just given is fantastic. Don't take that off of your roster. But loyalty, 5 years in a row, 10 years in a row, calling them
irrespective
to thank.
Irrespective of the size of the gift,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Just that kind of loyalty
yeah.
recognition for the that history.
Yeah. How gracious and thoughtful is that? If you just say, thank you for giving to us for five consecutive years, we really appreciate it. That's it.
And we didn't care how much it was.
Right.
Yeah. Marcy, thank you very much. We have to leave it there.
Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Marcy Brenholz, she is Director of Development for the Ralph Lauren Center for Cancer Care and Prevention. Thank you very much, Marcy, again.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio coverage of Fundraising Day 2014.
What Are the Wealthy Thinking is coming up. Now it's time for Tony's Take Two. Thank you. I'm grateful for all the ways that you support Nonprofit Radio, listening, getting my weekly email alerts, telling you who the guests are going to be, tweeting, retweeting, loving the show on Facebook. However it is you are enjoying Nonprofit Radio, I thank you. And my thank you video is at tonymartinetti.com. That's Tony's Take Two for Friday. It's a simple one. 4th of December, 45th show of the year. Here are Glenn McDonald and Stacey Palmer.
Welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio coverage of Fundraising Day 2014. We are at the Marriott Marquis Hotel in Times Square, New York City. With me now are Stacey Palmer and Glenn McDonald. Their workshop topic is what are the wealthy thinking now? It's a question, not a statement. We're going to answer that question. Stacey Palmer is editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. And Glenn McDonald is president of Wealth and Giving Forum. Stacey, Glenn, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Pleasure to have you, Glenn. Let's start with you. What is this topic all about? What are the wealthy thinking now?
Well, the first thing I want to say as a preface is that we like to categorize the wealthy as a homogenous group, but in fact,
that's really not fair to anybody.
They are
right?
Very diverse.
Yeah.
Just like any cohort group that you would mention. They span this political spectrum, young and old. You know that wealth can be minted very quickly, especially in Silicon Valley. And interestingly enough, on that topic, you know, it is young generation that is spurring new trends in giving. And the number one trend right now is thinking about their philanthropy across everything they do, not just in the checks they write, meaning how they invest their portfolio, and what sort of for-profit companies they invest in, ones that they believe they can be transformational in society.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really the number one trend that I see, and they are shifting the thinking of their parents and grandparents, to be quite frank.
And when you say the young, are we thinking of people in their 30s?
Early 20s coming out of college and thinking about the business choices they make, the careers they want to be involved with, the types of companies they want to work for. They want their doing good and doing well and making money to be integrated into one. It's no longer separate. And I think that's a trend that's here to stay. And I'm sure we've read, you know, in the press, in the Chronicle of Philanthropy, Wall Street Journal, that socially responsible investing and impact investing are considered alongside of the donations and grant making that foundations are making right now.
Stacey, what do you have to add early on?
I agree. That's one of the big trends. The other thing that some people are starting to talk about is whether there's a whole third wave of philanthropy coming among the young and whether Mark Zuckerberg really kicked that off. And he's not even 30 yet. But by giving so much money to the Silicon Valley Community Foundation rather than setting up his own foundation, he set a model for the other ways of thinking about giving, not institution building, but really saying, I want to do this differently. And others may be following his model. So I think we are seeing a pretty big shift.
Yeah. Glenn, a third wave?
I agree wholeheartedly. I think even before Mark Zuckerberg, Warren Buffett said, look, rather than build a new private foundation, I'm going to give my money to Bill Gates. I respect him. I trust him. I like his work. I like his team he's built. Why start over? I think, you know, Stacey and I would probably agree that the proliferation of new foundations and new nonprofits, when a lot of great organizations have already been built, small and large and everything in between, are already available to donors. And in some respects, by giving to the Community Foundation, what Mark Zuckerberg is saying, the staff is there, there's a lot of programs already in place, and we can be flexible because the Community Foundation structures allow for flexibility, not only in the way they give and the timing of giving, but also in the number of programs that are available.
Now, those watching the video will note that the room got darker. Tony Martinetti, Nonprofit Radio, is continuing, though. The overhead lights are flickering a little bit. They're coming on and off, but makes no difference. We persevere here at Nonprofit Radio.
Absolutely.
Nothing stops us. Earthquakes, bring them on. We will continue. We are not leaving this set until we flesh this out. Let's talk a little more, Stacey, about this third wave. What else characterizes this?
You know, I think in addition to things like impact investing, we also see growing interest in merging political giving and philanthropic giving.
Okay.
And thinking about the various ways that you can use your money to influence change. And of course, as campaign finance limits are basically going away, it's easier for the wealthy to think about doing that. And when you think about the scale of their political giving compared to philanthropy, it's so much smaller anyway. But they're definitely looking at both ways to do things. I think that's got good sides and bad sides. The good side is that they're getting engaged. The bad side is people are starting to worry about whether the plutocrats are setting policy, and we're starting to hear more about that. I think that could kick back on philanthropy in some pretty serious ways. So
I think we have
to talk about, you know, sort of, are people going to be accused of trying to sway public policy through their philanthropy?
And the wealthy setting the agenda, setting the research. Research priorities.
Indeed, but the flip side of that, of course, is that we all know that you can't create change unless you change some systems. Everybody in philanthropy has been talking about that for so long, so in some ways you would think that they might be applauding the billionaires for finally getting more engaged in public policy, but yet we don't see that.
Glenn, I see you nodding a lot. Yes.
I absolutely agree, and I think that, you know, in some respects there is some advocacy and political influence of the wealthy that are looking to take care of themselves by not having more taxes or eliminating regulations on businesses. And I think there the Koch brothers are a big example. And Tom Steyer on the other side of the fence would say, well, yes, but I'm advocating on behalf of those who don't have. But, you know, the challenge there is that while I think Tom Steyer is well-intentioned, that sometimes the billionaires advocating on behalf of those that are less fortunate don't really see the issues at the depth that the underbelly really does, and that they should be advocating for themselves. And the only way to do that is, you know, frankly, this is getting bleeding out of philanthropy and into a political commentary,
is
through true democracy. And so I think there is an issue, and Stacey's spot on in saying, you know, by philanthropy and the ability to raise .orgs to advocate and influence the political process, the challenge is that will philanthropy get, you know, a little bit of a black spot when there's so much goodness? Like in this room, you go upstairs, there's 1,000 organizations that are doing wonderful things that nobody hears about. And you don't want the nonprofit charitable sector and philanthropy world to be viewed as too linked to, you know, just the wealthy influencing the way the political game happens, because the real truth is there's so much goes on underneath that's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. Stacey, it looked like you wanted to add.
Well, and I also think part of it, too, is that there's so much in philanthropy that doesn't have anything to do with politics. And so that is why
we need to keep things in context.
Yeah, yeah.
What else? What else are you planning to? Your session is this afternoon. What else is on your minds for the audience?
I think one of the things we'll be talking about is the different ways to appeal to today's donors and to talk about what kinds of things draw them in. It's not enough just to say that they're motivated by a particular cause, but what kind of language do you use to get them engaged? You know, do you need to talk about financial metrics when you're appealing to an investor? Do you need to talk about how you're fixing things when you're talking to an entrepreneur? I was talking to a wealth advisor the other day who said she was advising an ophthalmologist, and he looks at everything through what people aren't seeing because that's what he does all day.
Yeah.
You know. And so trying to think about donors in those ways and what their professional obligations are, that might shape what it is that they want to hear about, how you draw them in and get them engaged. So we'll talk about tips for doing that.
So segmenting
absolutely
across your constituencies. Well, why don't you share? Can you share some of those tips? Let's not hold out on listeners.
Well, and I agree with Stacey. you know, the real challenge is that I say that the every individual who is a donor, giver, investor in for-profit solutions to social issues has his or her own formula for wanting to give, and it involves the head and the heart, and some are more head-oriented and rational thinking about, and they focus on outcomes and measurement more than the emotional joy of that comes sometimes from giving, and everything in between. And I think that, to Stacy's point, and wealth advisors have the same challenge in managing money, they have to figure out what makes the person tick. And I think the most important thing, and I think everybody in this room would agree, is what's most important is the discovery process, is the listening, and then the appeal can be couched in the framework of the individual, not in some standard way of soliciting money.
Yes, the listening.
The listening.
The listening, whether that's done through social media channels, right, or one-to-one right. conversation,
absolutely.
A survey. Yeah, I think that's something that I hear on the show often, is that we're not active listeners.
And you love listeners.
We have 9,000 of them. I do love them, and I listen to them, but they are sometimes not listening the way they need to be listening.
Exactly.
To their various constituents, whether that's vendors on one hand or you know, donors on the other. Yeah. Oh, somebody's trying to... Oh, watch that. Okay. Background noise bleeding in.
Like what you're hearing on Nonprofit Radio? Tony's got more. On YouTube, you'll find clips from his stand-up comedy, TV spots, and exclusive interviews. Catch guests like Seth Godin, Craig Newmark, the founder of Craigslist, Mark Echo of Echo Enterprises, Charles Best from DonorsChoose.org, Aria Finger of DoSomething.org, and Naomi Levine from New York University's Hyman Center on Philanthropy. Tony tweets, too. He finds the best content from the most knowledgeable and interesting people in and around nonprofits to share on his stream. If you have valuable info, he wants to retweet you. During the show, you can join the conversation on Twitter using hashtag Nonprofit Radio. Twitter is an easy way to reach Tony. He's at Tony Martinetti, MARTIGNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. He hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a short, monthly show devoted to getting you over your fundraising hurdles. Just like Nonprofit Radio, Tony talks to leading thinkers, experts, and cool people with great ideas. As one fan said, "Tony picks their brains and I don't have to leave my office." Fundraising Fundamentals was recently dubbed the most helpful nonprofit podcast you have ever heard. You can also join the conversation on Facebook, where you can ask questions before or after the show. The guests are there, too. Get insider show alerts by email. Tony tells you who's on each week and always includes links so that you can contact guests directly. To sign up, visit the Facebook page or TonyMartinetti.com.
If you have big dreams and a small budget, tune in to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. I do. I'm Adam Braun, founder of Pencils of Promise.
One further thought, and I'd be interested in Stacy's perspective on this as I'm just getting to know her, that comes to mind is that I've seen that the most committed philanthropists that really follow through on the long haul on and staying with the developing a strategy and then really staying through with an organization or an innovative non-for-profit leader that's starting something new or social issue to address is the ones who really do stay the course and have great impact and have patience for the outcomes, the right outcomes, are those that have been introspective and been thoughtful and taken a step back and not do something that's trendy, but something that really means something to them or their families.
But that takes a certain kind of investment and investors who are in for the long term. And, you know, Dan Pallotta had a lot to say about that.
Correct. Perfect example, right?
Yeah. Stacey, go ahead.
And we all know that one of the things that goes wrong in philanthropy all the time is that people follow the trendy. They want to start new organizations and get excited about the next new thing instead of staying for the long haul. And in some ways, what we need to change the culture of philanthropy is to say there are some of these organizations that are doing great work already. If they just had more money and more support from their board members, they could do even more. And that's not to say that new organizations shouldn't get started, but I think when people come into philanthropy, they just get excited about, I've got this innovative idea. Please back me, instead of saying, wait a minute, who's already doing terrific work? And how can I get involved in the board? And that's one of the things that nonprofits really need, is committed board members who will get involved and do that kind of thing as well. It's not enough just to write a check.
There's some sentiment that the passion takes over, and our system allows people to start a nonprofit as long as they can meet some not very high threshold requirements from the IRS, and that we then end up with a proliferation of charities duplicating, overlapping, rather than the person going to an existing charity and saying, if you don't have an opening for me on the board, can I partner some other way with you?
Exactly.
What about this proliferation of nonprofits? I mean, you see that hurting us?
Well, I think to Stacey's point at the beginning of this session that, Mark Zuckerberg and I added, Warren Buffett to the mix, and there's more and more that are saying, no, that isn't the right thing. And I think that by setting that example, that others are starting to take a step back and ask that question, which is a good trend. And I also think there's some consulting firms that are starting to encourage nonprofits to think about partnerships and merging and consolidating programs into one and gaining scale and leverage across. So that's starting to happen. We need more of it.
And some of it was by necessity in our great recession in the past 3 years.
Exactly, the 2008-2009 crisis forced with lower funding and some issues that even some endowed organizations, had poor performance and their operating budget suffered. That forced the issue, but it's a trend that's starting, but we need more of it, no question.
Yeah, we have an op-ed in our current issue that's actually arguing for that and saying that, really there needs to be more of a mergers and acquisitions business in the nonprofit field. The incentives are totally different than in business, but we need to find ways to think about ways for strong organizations to work together, not just because the financial crisis caused it, but for reasons to extend the mission and to think about it that way. And sometimes, we were just talking before about board members. It's often the board that gets in the way of a merger, because they don't want to give up their board membership. We've got to find some other incentives for them, because there's plenty of roles for them to get involved.
Yeah, there are precious few consultants. I've had one on Sabrina Lamb, I think. Sabrina Lamb, consultants doing advising around merger, acquisition, or even just joint ventures, partnerships, and not always for fundraising purposes, but for longer term, just mission achievement. There's that overlap is. Can be hurting us. What other any other strategies around the topics of listening?
I think one of the things that many fundraisers find challenging is that even if they are the ones who are doing the listening, getting the CEO, getting other people on the staff to do that listening is much more of a culture shift. And so one of the messages I think we'll probably talk about today is how to engage the chief executive and other people in the organization to see that talking to what a donor cares about doesn't mean sacrificing your ethics or, getting in the way of letting the donor dictate the mission. It's just saying, how do you talk to them in a language that they understand and that appeals to them? And maybe they do actually have some good ideas about how you run your organization differently that were worth listening to. But I think, so often that's one of the challenges fundraisers have, is they get it, but not everybody in the organization does.
Correct. And on the flip side, you might be talking to a donor who is really, it's the patriarch or matriarch or maybe even the son or daughter of a wealthy family. And sometimes the whole family is going to be part of the decision process. So it makes that dynamic and challenge a little bit more complicated, because sometimes family members may seemingly be on the same page till the time comes for the check to be written. And then there's some, well, wait a minute, that doesn't really have, is not in concert with the mission of our private foundation. And one argues yes, and the other argues no. And So look, that's why this is a profession. I mean, fundraising is a huge challenge. You've got to work the organization on the one hand, and as Stacy pointed out, and on the other hand, sometimes the dynamics, the emotional dynamics of the one individual donor and or the family dynamics associated with that donor makes it an interesting challenge.
And if we're seriously interested in listening, then we have to be asking questions, the answers to which we need to be willing to hear.
And they're often not.
Go ahead, please.
Couldn't have said it better. I mean, you know, that's why I mentioned the discovery process. If that's not part of the question set, who's else involved in this decision process? I know you have a private foundation. Do you have professionals as part of the private foundation that are going to influence this? Do you have other family members that are going to come and weigh in on the decision? And should we be meeting with them and so forth? And those are absolutely.
A lot of times, you know, for smaller and maybe even mid-sized shops, you know, you need often, I think, an outside advisor to help facilitate this process. And a lot of the smaller shops, you know, they don't have the wherewithal to bring someone in to facilitate a conversation on the board, or a conversation among donors, you know, and they're so insular in their work that they're not able to ask these challenging questions.
I think one of the things all nonprofits, no matter what size they are, can seek out is professionals who want to give their time to facilitate something like that. I mean, most people would like to help an organization in various ways, and you know, we don't think about the sort of skilled volunteering enough and the ways that people can help out. So you would say, you know, an organization of any size can really reach out to people who can help in that process, and should be creative in thinking about that rather than just asking for money, because you're right, sometimes you need more of that kind of coaching and that sort of thing. Glenn, I think one of the things you talked about in our call was thinking about mentors for people thinking about the way people in their profession want to meet other people in their profession, and that's a good way for nonprofits to think about how to find new donors and volunteers.
Yeah, and a couple of things on that was, well, we believe the Wealth and Giving Forum, we believe in peer learning. And so we really exist to encourage greater philanthropy. And in that regard, our sweet spot is emerging philanthropists, but we have other philanthropists come and tell their stories about how they develop their own formula for giving. And the struggles and challenges they ask themselves about how much to give and what's the direction of my giving and how do I involve my family and how do I ensure that I'm not going to get donor fatigue and so forth and so on. And it's really, I think peer-to-peer learning in any field of endeavors is hugely important. That's why there's a lot of, you know, organizations like Young Presidents Organization for CEOs and so forth and so on. But even for nonprofit professionals, I mean, there's a great couple of organizations that are just, I don't know if you've heard of Catch a Fire.
Oh, sure. Yeah, when Stacey was talking, I was going to mention Catch a Fire Volunteer Match.
Right. So in order to get, you know, if you need an accounting or you're having board challenges or you're having, you know, they will find professionals who can help come in and advise the nonprofits on those issues and challenges. And then one new one I just heard about was Inspiring Capital that, I mean, really just organized this year to help nonprofits think about intellectual capital and capabilities they developed that might be a source of revenue stream because they've developed this expertise. You know, I'll give you one example. A Year Up, a national, you know, organization that helps inner-city youth find a pathway to self-sustaining, you know, income and a great career. And, you know, they've become very well-known, but they've really developed over the past 15 years a great capability to not only train young adults in inner cities, but also to staff them properly and so... You know, they have a model that can compete with Robert Half. So they're, you know, thinking about a revenue stream off of that that can help fund the organization. And I think more and more nonprofits are going to start doing the same thing.
Yeah. Stacey, we have just a minute or so left. Want to leave a parting thought, something we haven't talked about that you plan to share?
One of the things that is clear in giving trends overall is that the affluent are the ones that are powering giving's growth in America. We just saw the Giving USA report come out, and were it not for the wealthy, I don't think we would have seen the good numbers that we saw. So making sure that every organization of every size reaches out to these individuals is really important, rather than focusing on things like special events and other kinds of things. I think almost every organization has the capacity to get what is for them a major gift, and they really should be thinking about that.
And important, yeah, for them.
For them.
Everybody doesn't need to be going after 7, 8, 9-figure gift.
Exactly. A $10,000 gift might be a big gift for you. Go for it.
Excellent. We're going to leave it right there.
That's well perfect. Put.
I love that. All right. Stacey Palmer, editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy, and Glenn McDonald, president of Wealth and Giving Forum. I want to thank you both very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Tony.
My pleasure. It's Tony Martinetti, nonprofit radio coverage of Fundraising Day 2014. Thank you so much for being with us.
Next week, it'll be a good one. Is there another kind? If you missed any part of today's show, find it on TonyMartinetti.com. Where in the world else would you go? We're sponsored by Pursuant, online tools for small and mid-sized nonprofits, whatever type of work you do to improve our world. Pursuant.com. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. Sam Leibowitz is the line producer. Gavin Dahl is our AM and FM outreach director. The show's social media is by Dinah Russell, while Susan Chavez is on maternity leave. And our music is by Scott Stein. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.
What's not to love about nonprofit radio? Tony gets the best guests. Check this out from Seth Godin.
This is the first revolution since TV 1950 and Henry Ford 1920. It's the revolution of our lifetime.
Here's a smart, simple idea from Craigslist founder Craig Newmark.
Yeah, in sites or in presentation or anything, people don't really need the fancy stuff. They need something which is simple and fast.
When's the best time to post on Facebook? Facebook's Andrew Noyes knows.
At traffic is at an all-time high around 9 a.m. or 8 p.m. So that's when you should be posting your most meaningful posts.
Here's Aria Finger, COO of DoSomething.org.
Young people are not going to be involved in social change if it's boring and they don't see the impact of what they're doing. So you got to make it fun and applicable to these young people, because otherwise a 15 and 16-year-old, they have better things to do. They have Xbox, they have TV, they have their cell phones.
Ami Dar is the founder of Idealist.
It took 2 or 3 years for foundation staff to sort of deign to add an email address to their card. Yes. It was like, it was phone. This email thing is right. Weird. Plus, why should I give it away?
Charles Best founded DonorsChoose.org.
Somehow they've gotten in touch, kind of offline, as it were.
Yeah.
And know to exchanges of brownies and visits and physical gift.
Mark Echo is the founder and CEO of Echo Enterprises. You may be wearing his hoodies and shirts. Tony talked to him.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big believer that it's not what you make in life. It's you know, it's how you make people feel.
This is public radio host Majora Carter.
Innovation is in the power of understanding that you don't just, you know, you just put money on a situation and expect it to heal. You put money on a situation and invest it and expect it to grow.
And savvy advice for success from Eric Saperston.
What separates those who achieve from those who do not is in direct proportion to one's ability to ask others for help.
The smartest experts and leading thinkers are on Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%.